on today's episode of the Law of Tech podcast.
These are acts that are going to shape the digital economy and the digital sector in general for the next decade. So I think it's a pivotal year, but the story doesn't end there. So it's really the beginning of a new book, but 2022 is an important year in saying we need to find a balance, a trade-off, come agreement on a compromise on how to do this, and then we'll see.
Hi, and welcome to a new episode of the second season of the Law of Tech podcast. In this episode, we'll be chatting about predictions, promises, and expectations in light of the European data strategy. And for this, I'm joined by Thomas Tombal. Thomas is a researcher in ICT law focusing on competition, data sharing, and data protection issues linked to the data economy. In September 2021, he joined the Tilburg Institute for Law, Technology and Society, also known as TILT, to conduct postdoctoral research on the research program From Regulating Human Behavior to Regulating Data, and also on the subproject Protecting Autonomy in a Data-Driven Society. Now, before joining TILT, Thomas worked as a researcher at the Centre de Recherche Information Droit et Société. Let's hope that was the right pronunciation.
It was.
At the University of Namur in Belgium, where he also obtained his PhD and worked on several interdisciplinary research projects pertaining to the digitalization and use of big data and AI by public administrations. Thomas, welcome to the show and thanks for kicking off the second season with me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Very, very excited for this this chat, because I think that there is a lot going on in the European Union with regard to data, and in particular the new data strategy that has been introduced not so long ago. Before we kind of get into the European data strategy itself, I was wondering if we maybe could delve deeper into some of the background that kind of eventually led to this the introduction of the European data strategy. Can you maybe tell us about the context in which we kind of should understand the introduction, implementation, also further development of this strategy?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the context, I think it's familiar to everyone, is that we're in a society that is increasingly digital. And I mean, COVID, the COVID pandemic showed this even more. So internet is basically a must utility. And nowadays you have platforms that we use every day. They're an integrating part of our everyday life. I mean, we all use search engines, we all use social network, we all shop online. And so basically all of this brings out tremendous opportunities. And I mean, that's why they developed in the first place, because they fit the need that we had. But there's also some downfalls to it. And just to take social media without naming any specific platform, you know, a lot of people actually access most of their news, their information through social media. And that leads to a lot of disinformation, because, you know, the way social media are created is that they want you to stay as long as possible on the platform. So they show you content that the algorithm considers is the one that is going to hook you up the most, and that content might not necessarily be the best in terms of the quality of the information in there. It might be harmful without being illegal, and I mean, that's a whole topic that we could discuss, but I think it would be better for another podcast. I mean, you look from a political point of view, you see political parties, especially from the far left and the far right, that invest massively in publicity on social networks, and it actually works. I mean, if I just think of Belgium, the far-right Flemish party was the party that invested the most in social media in the past election, and they had a huge jump in their in the number of voters they got. So all of this to say, these instruments are great, but they also have major downfalls. And we are starting to realize more and more how big and how dangerous these downfalls could be, and that we need to do something about it. And these actors, I mean, why are they so powerful? I mean, it's the power of data, it's the power of algorithms. They have tech experts that, you know, they attract the brains to the Silicon Valley that kind of want to flee Europe because the conditions, the pace and everything are better. And, you know, California is also a nice place to live. They have more computational ability. And so this makes them very powerful. And I think now legislators, especially at the European level, are realizing, okay, these are great. They bring great stuff, but we also need to rein in their power a bit because we're losing control. And the data strategy is part of that. I mean, the data strategy is not the only thing to try to rein in their power, but I think it fits in this global context.
Like you said, and we'll definitely get back to this at a later stage. Kind of the balancing of all these interests is extremely difficult, and that really challenges the way forward in how we as a European Union then should kind of respond to the ongoing developments. But before we move to that, zooming in on the European data strategy itself, maybe it's good to kind of give some insight into what exactly it is. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about the contents of this strategy, maybe the vision that kind of underpins it and its objectives?
Yeah. So, I mean, the European strategy, it's a recent instrument. It's from 2020, but it didn't come out of nowhere in 2020. So I think it's also important to say, yes, they came up with this in 2020, but this is based on discussions about the data economy that have been going on at least since 2013, 2014. There have been several communications. For example, personally, the 2016 communication by the Commission called Building a European Data Economy, that was kind of basically the instrument that I read. And I was like, okay, this gave me an idea for my PhD. So, I mean, this has been around for a while. And the data strategy kind of builds on these discussions that had been going on for 5 to 6 years. And basically the objectives is to say, okay, we understand now a bit better the power of data. We understand that we need to have a better use of data, both for economic reasons, to have more competitive markets, to increase productivity, but also for societal reasons. I think that's important. That's a message I want to convey as well, that we often talk about, okay, it's important to have more competition, to have greater economy, but it's also, I think, important to underline that more data sharing, more data reuse can also have incredibly valuable societal effects in terms of improving of health, well-being, the environment, more transparent governance, increasing mobility, etc. And so broadly speaking, that's kind of what the European strategy wants to do, is better use of data for both economic and societal purposes, and also to empower individuals more, like to empower you, me, anyone listening to better use their data, to be more in control. And this, for example, comes through like the data portability rights. But doing all of this, and I think it comes back to this balancing that we will get back to later, but doing all of this, pushing for more sharing, more openness, while still respecting the fundamental European values, respecting privacy, respecting fundamental rights, ensuring sufficient competition, ensuring sufficient consumer protection. And so I think that's also the characteristic, this focus on fundamental rights and values. It's the characteristics of the strategy. And then maybe just quickly, concretely, I mean, the strategy relies on our four pillars, on what it entails. So but I would group them in basically three types of initiatives that would fall within it. The first one is a baseline framework for horizontal sharing and reuse of data across sectors. And within that objective, you have several instruments. So you have the Data Governance Act that we can come back to later. There's also the review of the Public Sector Information Directive, so the Open Data Directive, which also increased the reach of open data. It extended it to high-value data sets, to research data. And we're also going to have the Data Act that should come out in February, though there it's still a bit unclear exactly what's going to be in it. But so you have kind of like this first approach of, we need a basic horizontal framework for sharing across sector, because sharing and reuse is not only valuable within sectors, but also across sectors. Then the second element is more sharing, and then in this case, within sectors. And there, the idea of the strategy is to create a common European data spaces in strategic sectors, so in the environment, in agriculture, in mobility, etc. So basically domains of public interest where you have sectoral regulation. So first horizontal, second sectoral, and then on top of that, The third one I would say is empowering individuals, investing in their skills and in SMEs. And there notably comes, for example, by enhancing the existing portability rights. And this might be done in the Data Act, we'll have to see. But so basically it's really understanding the power of data and seeing how we can make a good use of it a bit across the board.
One of the things that I kind of want to refer back to in what you just were talking about is like the relationship between the European data strategy and other initiatives within the European Union. You mentioned that it is part of like the broader vision that the European Union has. And one thing that I kind of noted whilst conducting research for this episode is that the European data strategy was kind of introduced at the same time as that the European Union also introduced its vision for its digital future. And there were some other ongoing activities at the time. How does it kind of relate to this broader vision? And also, maybe we can immediately kind of talk about this too, to some of the other regulatory initiatives in the field, like for instance, the GDPR, or now some proposals that we're looking at, for instance, the Artificial Intelligence Act and Digital Services Act, for instance, also.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, obviously, as I said, this is part of a bigger mix of initiatives to kind of better regulate the digital world. And I was saying, you know, these big actors, they're powerful for several reasons. They're powerful because they have more data than others. They're powerful because since they have more data than others, they can better train their algorithms, and their algorithms are obviously work better. They can attract more tech experts, and you know, they have more computational ability. So these are kind of all different areas where the EU can act. And so obviously, while the data strategy is very much focused on the data aspect, trying to allow more access to the idea, basically to have more undertakings having the ability to use this data and to use it, you know, kind of as the oil. We always hear data is the new oil, but it's really as the oil that is going to allow them to train and their algorithms. So that's kind of the idea behind the strategy focusing on the data. And I mean, you have other instruments outside of the strategy that also focus on these data elements. I mean, you look at you were talking about the Shaping Europe's Digital Future communication, and under that, what we have is the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act. Well, the Digital Markets Act, it doesn't necessarily focus on data or algorithm. I mean, it focuses on both, but not for the sake of regulating data or algorithm, but there the target is more regulating some big players and imposing things on them that have to do with how they manage the data, how they manage their algorithm, how they create their services. So there is some complementarity here. So this is more focused on data, but then we also have initiatives that focus more on the algorithm. And there, obviously, you have the AI Act that focuses more on what you can do actually with this data. So data strategy is more about who can have the data and how do we share it. And then you have the AI Act. It's like, okay, you have the data. What can you actually do with it in terms of the algorithms that you put out there? And the Digital Services Act is a little bit also more focused on this algorithmic, you know, how do you show content? Do you have to filter it? Are we going to go ahead with advertising and things like that? Are they liable online if a user on YouTube puts up a video that has some potentially terrorist content or things like that? You know, so this links more to the content than to the data as such. But there's an overlapping, so that's always why it might be a bit at first hand you could say, okay, they come from a slightly different objective. There are some overlaps, so I think that's an important point, and it also explains why there's a bit of time around adopting them, that we need to kind of make sure that they work well together. And then in terms of how the coming back more to the strategy, how it ties in with existing legislation and especially the GDPR. I mean, naturally, when we talk about data, the topic of personal data instantly comes to mind. So it's absolutely vital for the strategy to tie into this. And here, I think it's interesting to go back a little bit in history. Well, I mean, not so far back, but 2016. So the communication building a European data economy that kind of launched my PhD research. There, what the commission tried to do is to say, okay, we have the GDPR that has just been adopted. It wasn't in force yet because it would have been turned in force in May 2018. But you say, okay, we have this good instrument for personal data. So now what we're going to do is we're going to regulate non-personal data and kind of making this artificial distinction between personal and non-personal data, which on paper sounds great, but in practice just, you know, doesn't work. Because at the end of the day, well, the definition of personal data is so broad that, you know, as Nadia Pokhtova explained in a brilliant article, I mean, it's basically the law of everything, because almost everything can be personal data if you wish. But even if not, a bunch of data sets are what we call mixed data sets. You have personal and non-personal data combined, and you know, it would be very complicated to tell an undertaking, okay, all the personal data you put in one server and you treat it like that, and on the non-personal you put in on the other server and you treat it like that. So the distinction was quite artificial, and you see in the evolution of the thought all the way to the strategy and now the Data Governance Act and hopefully the Data Act that will come a bit later, you don't really have this distinction anymore. It's more, okay, we have to regulate data in general, and we understand that there is this specific protection for personal data. And so it kind of becomes, how do we make this work together? So it's not necessarily that they clash, because this goal, and I think that the commission kind of sums it up as, we need to be as open as necessary. So that's kind of the data strategy, but also as closed as possible. So, and there's respecting data protection. And so it's kind of finding this balance that is always a bit the tricky part, but it's not necessarily counterintuitive. But I hope that will be so in the Data Act. I just think that we need to do a little bit of better job at exactly saying how we make it work together. Because basically, I might be a bit caricatural here, but basically what we have now in these regulations is to say, okay, this is all provided that we respect the rules of the GDPR. And when we do all of this, we need to respect the rule of the GDPR. And that's about it. So, you know, it gives you the instruction. You need to look at the GDPR and respect it, but it's not very clear on how you're actually supposed to work that out in practice. And I think that's what the sector, the different actors are going to have to do in the coming months and year, is to kind of figure out, okay, we have these two regimes. I am told that I need to apply both simultaneously. How do I work this out? So I think that's going to be the challenge a bit for the future.
Yeah, I think I would definitely agree with that also. Now I think that it does, though, require a lot of work. You kind of, first of all, you mentioned some of your ideas on how, for instance, the Data Act should kind of be looked at and further developed. But in general, I think that kind of reaching this balance will, you know, take a lot of work from the side of the European Union and its collaboration with other parties. And one thing that you recently mentioned also is that 2022 is believed to be a pivotal year for the European in terms of its data strategy. Now, I was interested to hear from you, why do you think 2022 will be pivotal in this regard, and what should we kind of be expecting to see?
Yeah, so I mean, it's pivotal in a way, but it's also only just the beginning of the story. So to make it a bit clearer, I mean, it's pivotal because we're going to have a lot of important acts that should be adopted if all goes well in 2022. I mean, we were talking about the Data Governance Act. They already reached an agreement in the trilogue at the end of last year. So, I mean, the text should come out anytime soon now. And that's kind of like the first stepping stone of the strategy. But then you also have the Digital Service Act, the Digital Market Act, that both entered a trilogue negotiation. And I mean, France has made it very clear that they want to adopt these, the DMA, ideally by the end of March, because, you know, they want to sell this as a win for the re-election campaign of Emmanuel Macron. The DSA, probably it would be unrealistic to say that it would be adopted by March, but they surely want to try to be able to adopt it by the end of their presidency, so by the end of June. Then we're going to have, in February, end of February, beginning of March, normally we should have the proposal for the Data Act. So these are kind of all acts that are that are going to shape the future, that are going to shape the digital economy for the and the digital sector in general for the next decade. So I think it's a pivotal year in terms of what exactly are we going to put in there, because these are going to be the rules for the next year. But it doesn't. The story doesn't end there. I mean, then we're going to need to see how these texts are concretely implemented. We're going to need to wait for the first decisions. So that's not going to be before, 2023, 2024. So it's really the beginning of a new book, but it's important. But it's pivotal, I think, because these acts, and it also explains why it took a bit of time to arrive to the proposal and why these are being heavily discussed. Is that you need to strike the right balance, because data sharing and data reuse is not a goal in itself. I mean, the idea is not to say data sharing sounds nice, let's do data sharing for the sake of data sharing. Like, that's not the idea. The idea is to say, okay, we realize that data sharing can have incredibly valuable economic, societal, or empowerment goals. So let's try to see how we can push that, but keeping in mind that there are also costs to data sharing. I mean, there are obviously costs for the undertaking that has to share the data, okay? Because you used to, for example, have an advantageous position because you were the only one having that data, and now all of a sudden you need to share it. And okay, the act of sharing in itself is not costly, but you invested massively in collecting and processing that data. So if, from one day to the other, you're like, okay, you invested billions in this, and now the guy next door can just get it for free. Well, in terms of innovation, you need to make sure that you get this right. There are obviously the data protection considerations that we talk about. There are short-term and long-term considerations. So all of this requires this appropriate balancing. And I think that's why I would say that it's a pivotal year, because I think it's the year where we need to get it right. But I also want to say that I think it's important to have something. Like, there is not one perfect solution. So I think what matters is that there are several options, and we need to agree on one. And I think it's important to agree on a reasonable one, but it's also important to agree by knowing, this is not the one and only solution, and it's okay if we don't get it exactly right the first time. So I think 2022 is an important year in saying we need to find a balance, a trade-off, come agreement on a compromise on how to do this. And then we'll see. We'll see in the next 2, 3, 4 years how this works. And if we need to tweak it along the road, then we will. It's important to start somewhere, and obviously somewhere reasonable. And that's why there are so many decisions. But it's okay if we don't get it right and we need to tweak it a bit down the road.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very interesting point that you made, because obviously we've seen, I don't know exactly what the reason was for the Data Act to be kind of moved from this being proposed in December 2021 to now 2022. I'm not sure if there was or what the specific reason was, but we kind of also see it with regard, for instance, the DSA, where there were big hopes, I think, for that proposal. But when it came out, I think many were disappointed in a way. And there will be a lot of discussions kind of allowing the DSA to possibly take quite some time to actually become a real piece of regulation. Does it concern you that we might actually not come to some sort of compromise in the end? Or do you think that's not likely to happen?
I think it's unlikely that we will not get anywhere. I mean, the Data Governance Act were there. Basically, I think it's just some fine tuning right now, but the fundamental agreement is there. The DMA, I mean, they all agree on the objectives, and when you look at what they're discussing, I wouldn't call them fundamental points of the. They all agree on the objectives. They all agree on what they want to do. So the DMA, I'm extremely confident that it will be adopted at least during the French presidency. The DSA, I'm not sure that we will manage to adopt it. I mean, I say we in general, the European Union, will be able to adopt it by the end of the French presidency, because it's a bit more discussed. But I do believe that we should have something in 2022, because I think they do realize that it's important to move forward. But I think it's a bit more tricky in terms of fundamental fundamental rights at stake. So that also explains why it's going to take a bit more time. But I do expect that we would get somewhere. Then again, you know, I was thinking that about the e-privacy regulation that should be revised, the e-privacy directive, and that kind of has stalled much longer than expected. So you never know. For the Data Act, it's a bit more unclear why this has been pushed. My understanding is that it's not exactly clear. It was not exactly clear to the technical experts that were asked to kind of review the document where exactly the commission wants to go with this. And I think it's especially because while all the other pieces of this puzzle, it's a bit clearer how they are next to each other and how they fit with each other. I feel like the Data Act is kind of a little bit of an instrument that has more potential overlaps with all of these instruments. So I think they probably the technical experts wanted a bit more clarification on how this is gonna fit in the whole picture. I don't expect the Data Act to be adopted this year. That for sure not. At best, it will be in 2023. But all the other acts, I do expect that this would happen this year.
Now, kind of moving towards the wrap up, I think of this episode, there are two more things that I was interested to kind of talk about with you. And one of them was the business to government data sharing, which I found interesting because it immediately kind of triggers topics like surveillance or governments getting too much power over their citizens, even though we've seen that this can also have tremendous beneficial effects, for instance, during the COVID pandemic. What is your take on the B2G data sharing?
Yeah, so it's obviously a bit more of an emergent topic compared to what we have discussed up to now, and it's definitely more of an emergent topic compared to its reverse, which is government to business sharing, so the open data aspect. But it's quite new, but in a way it kind of came up already, this idea of business to government data sharing, in the review of the open data directive, so in the public consultation, so around 2018, if I remember correctly. And there they were saying, okay, should we introduce what they called reverse open data, if you want? So, okay, now right now we have undertakings that get data from the public sector in order to do something with it. Well, shouldn't we do it the other way around? So it kind of it emerged a bit there. There were in a further communication by the commission in 2018, there were some guidelines on this is not compulsory, but if you want to share data with the government, like this is just the frame of how we advise to do this. Then there was a high level expert group on B2G that was kind of appointed to kind of rethink about these proposals from based in the communication. And now we are expecting in the Data Act to have something about business to government data sharing. There is already some form of business to government data sharing in the Data Governance Act. Well, they call it data altruism, but there again, it's purely voluntary. So the Data Governance Act does not impose this. My understanding is that the Data Act would make it compulsory for some private undertakings to share data with the public sector in certain cases of public interest. And I mean, obviously, as you said yourself, there are great benefits to it. I mean, COVID was an example. There are huge benefits potentially in terms of environment, mobility, health. But this also creates concerns. Obviously, the undertakings are like, okay, I don't necessarily mind sharing my data with an authority to, for example, you know, allow them to better plan mobility, but I want to make sure that data is not then shared down the line with potential competitors, or, you know, so there's kind of a fear of losing a bit of control. But I mean, I think there are ways to alleviate this. We talk more and more about privacy sandboxes. Well, I think we could have, you know, data sharing sandboxes in this B2G environment. And then obviously, yes, there's this whole discussion about surveillance. And it is a legitimate concern. But what always strikes me when we talk about this is that we never talk about the counterpart, which is capitalism surveillance, as coined by Dr. Zuboff in Harvard. You say, you know, we give... we're extremely afraid to give data to public authorities because we don't want to be surveilled. And I mean, there are historical reasons to that. But we're actually just giving troves and troves of data to private undertakings, and we're allowing capitalism surveillance. And there somewhere, we don't have the same, the same reaction of defiance. So I think that is not to say that, you know, we do it with the private sector, so why should we bother with the public? But my point is more to be okay. Like, this should not necessarily be a showstopper, but we need to address both of these issues of surveillance more generally. But these are legitimate concerns. But I think there are ways to frame it, you know, if you create data silos that, you know, you just share it with one specific unit within a ministry that is not allowed to share it with others. I mean, you can figure out a way to make this B2G data sharing work for everybody while limiting. Of course, you can never completely delete all the risks, but at least while limiting the risks.
No, I think it's, once again, interesting because it kind of shows, or at least what I understand from what you're saying throughout the entire episode, is like this kind of shift also in perspective. In terms of, for instance, this particular part where we're talking about regular surveillance by governments, which we should also shift towards surveillance capitalism, for instance, but also in terms of the GDPR, that we shouldn't only be looking at, okay, so how does this kind of fit on its own, but also how does it fit with like the European data strategy? Where is the overlap? Where is the balance? And I think that also kind of applies to this, whereas once again, the balance in sharing data from businesses to governments, but also the other way around and just in general. Now, kind of moving towards the actual wrap up of the episode, I mean, you've given a lot of insight into where you kind of think we're heading, and in terms of the expectations we also should have, especially in 2022, but also more generally, I think, with regard to the European data strategy. Maybe some final remarks from your side on where you believe the EU should be heading in terms of its data strategy, in order to kind of ensure that using data doesn't become a pawn in kind of this political or power game, but really is established for the benefit of the whole of society, like you also have mentioned the benefits before.
Yeah, so obviously that's a tricky thing to do for the EU, because you obviously have these great powers. I mean, traditionally, when we talk about like international competition on regulating these things, we always mention, you know, China, the US, and the EU. And I mean, now you can obviously also mention the UK, because they since the Brexit, but they to some extent they still kind of follow the same trajectory to a large extent as the EU, and of course there are other emerging countries that have their strategy as well. But you know, I think it's important for the EU to kind of keep its directing line, which is to say, you know, we're not the US and we're not China, obviously. And I mean, that's not without saying, like, you know, which one is better than the other. It's just we come from different political backgrounds. We come from different ways of seeing regulation. So it's important that we stick to what we think is important. And it's, you know, all of this is always relying on the European fundamental rights, on the European fundamental values. And I think that is something that we really need to keep in mind. And probably this doesn't come up so much in the data strategy, but I mean, when you look at the regulation of the AI Act, I mean, there it's very clear that we're trying to do it the European way and not doing the US way or the China way. And I think it's important to kind of keep that direction. And, you know, we've seen that the European way can have an influence. I mean, we talked several times about the GDPR. The GDPR had a massive effect internationally. You know, and now we always talk about the Brussels effect of, you know, how the GDPR influenced how these global actors implement, or at least are supposed to implement, data protection in their services. So I think it's important to understand that, you know, we can have an influence doing it our way. So I think it would be a mistake to change our way of doing it just for the sake of competing with the other nations. I think it's, you know, we need to have our own focus and do it that way. I mean, that is not to say that it's necessarily going to be perfect. I mean, you look at the GDPR, while the rules are good, the enforcement is having some issues now, but But, you know, I think we need to stick to what we do best in the European level. And hopefully, you know, we also need to trust the citizens also at the end of the day that, you know, they're going to understand that, maybe that that service coming from China sounds amazing on paper. But, you know, when you actually realize what some of the downfalls that might be behind, you're like, okay, then maybe this alternative service is something that I want. So I think it's really important, yeah, for the Commission to and Europe in the European institutions in general to kind of follow that lead. So keep the human at the center, keep the fundamental values, the fundamental rights at the center.
So doing it the European way. I think that's quite a nice way to, or a nice message to end this podcast with. And on that note, I once again want to thank you also for sharing your insights. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow the Law of Tech on social media. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast. Yeah.